Good morning. Let's meditate together for a few minutes. All right, welcome. Are you ready for launching into thyroid conversation?
I would love to talk about thyroids.
Okay, pull up your question. All right, I have been getting a lot of questions about thyroid issues. The questions are from women in workshops where the questions are more general in nature. These are questions from women both in their late 20s and early 30s and perimenopausal women. Of course, some want to better understand hypothyroid, others hyperthyroid, and some Hashimoto's syndrome. The question I have is how to begin to explain to them how thyroid is impacted by our stress hormone, sex hormone imbalances. If there's not a kavaigunya, it's a ka and then a vaigunya. So K-H-A, ka means space, right? Like akasha, sort of. So sukha, dukkha, good space, bad space. Ka is space, K-H-A, vai, V-A-I, gunya, G-U-N-Y-A. All right, so she says, if there is not a kavaigunya and the women are living a more sattvic than most, albeit at times stress-drenched life, is it Agni and low Ojas? What about Manas Prakriti? I keep thinking it's about Rajas. Maybe they need to increase Rajas to get out of Tamas, and the physical body did not get the note that the job was done. So cute. All right, so thyroid is, I'm going to give you the short answer first, and then we're going to muck around in this for a while. It's really worth mucking around in. Everybody knows what I'm talking about when I say the bucket syndrome, right? Okay, if you don't, go back and listen to Healthier Hormones course. The short answer, remember when we're talking about the bucket syndrome, that all else being equal, and I'll go back to what I mean by that in a minute, but basically it's as long as the person doesn't have a kavaigunya, right? All else being equal, the endocrine system gets hit in the following order if the bucket syndrome goes on for too long. The order is first the adrenals, then the insulin-producing portion of the pancreas, then the thyroid, than other things. And I got that from Dr. John Lee somewhere in probably one of his newsletters a long time ago. So I don't know that that's true, but that's what's always in my head because of that. And I think it's a good rule of thumb. And why I say I don't know is because in my practice, I didn't have people go get blood tests all the time. So I'm going by what I'm seeing. What I'm seeing with adrenal burnout is just what I call that because I didn't have people go and get their blood levels checked all the time. So I don't know. But what I see with that is, okay, bucket syndrome goes on long enough, people get pretty darn fatigued. Their immune system goes kind of low, like they start picking up more colds and flus and things like that. And their kidney pulses are low. That's the main thing for me is the kidney energy in terms of what we talk about. In Chinese medicine, they talk about the organs and the organ pulses a lot more than they do in Ayurveda. And I find it to be very helpful in this context. There's different things helpful in different contexts, but in this context, to determine whether the adrenal function is low, is I think about, is the kidney function low? Because the adrenals and the kidneys are like one in the same system in Chinese medicine, and they're often talked about in the same breath in Ayurvedic medicine. And indeed, physiologically, the adrenals are these little thumb-sized glands that hang out sitting on top of the kidneys. So they're really connected to the kidney system. So if the kidney system seems low to me, I will certainly think about adrenal fatigue. So the kidney system being low, first of all, the kidney pulses feel low. There feels like a low vitality in the person. The kidneys in Chinese medicine, and I'm going to bring this in, even though we're all Ayurvedic students, I think it's useful. The kidney system in Chinese medicine, they are the reserve organ. When you outspend your resources, where you dig into is your adrenals, right, is your kidney system. If you don't have enough juice, you dig into the kidneys. If you don't have enough energy, you dig into the kidneys. In fact, so interesting about the kidneys, look at how many organs in the body are single organs. There's one heart, there's one large intestine, there's one small intestine, there's one stomach, there's one liver, there's one spleen, there's one pancreas, there's one hypothalamus, there's all these ones, right? And there's a few organs that are two. This is the kind of thing that I love, right? And that I just would think about for days in the back of my head, right? What organs are there two of?
Lungs. Sexual organs.
Lungs, sexual organs, and kidneys, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, those are the big ones. To me, whenever there's what I think of when there's two of an organ and not just one, is that those organs have something powerful to do with duality. Even in the brain, there's the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere, right? Mm-hmm. And the hypothalamus is in the middle, kind of trying to pull it all together, right? So where organs are situated to me is really interesting. Like, if we could talk about the esoteric reasons, in a sense, or the subtle reasons for why the organs are placed where they're placed, mm-hmm. to me that visual is really interesting. Mm-hmm. You follow?
Yeah.
So, and we've got two nostrils that lead to the two lungs, and the two nostrils lead to Ida and Pingala. And those are the most powerful systems we have. The Ida and Pingala work with them is the most powerful direct way we have, because of all the things we have studied in the Healthier Hormones course, those are the most powerful ways we have to direct, to affect the mind and the prana and the rasa, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the breath. And there's this thing that is so obscure in Chinese medicine that where they say they're talking about the different function of the different organs, and there's this obscure thing they say about the lungs, and they say the lungs govern the entering and the exiting of jing. That's how they put it. And jing is like ojas. It's the equivalent of ojas. So the lungs govern the entering and exiting of ojas is how that would translate. And I'm going to say it again, and we just look at this for a minute. The lungs govern the entering and exiting of ojas. Now think about it. Prana follows focus. Ojas lines up behind what we're focusing on. If we are focused on something and if we do like that dissolving obstructions track on my prana CD that, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of moving stagnation, we are focusing our attention and bringing the prana there, bringing the breath there, and creating space that what it feels like to me is that space allows tejas to turn the stagnation into ojas almost. And that ojas, in a sense, that is responsible for the full feeling of prana. Prana doesn't feel empty, does it? When we feel our pranamaya kosha and we're working with prana in our systems, it doesn't feel empty, does it? The full feeling of prana. And remember, I mean, none of this is reality. We're just trying to describe reality. We're trying to describe Naquan, what we can see in our bodies. So take it or leave it. This is just what it feels like to me. You know, we can see ojas and not see it. It's a substance and it's not a substance. It's this weird thing, right? But to me, how I feel ojas and how I feel that what OGIS represents of that healthy immunity and the glow and that full feeling, that's the full feeling that imbues prana. They're not separate. They're embedded together. But if the prana is stuck, then that OGIS is just stuck stuff. But if it gets transformed through Tejas, then we get OGIS, right? So lungs govern the entering and exiting of OGIS. Where we focus on, where we breathe into, OGIS follows there. It infuses that area. It imbues that area. We get, our focus gets to decide where OGIS comes and goes, where it enters and exits. If we want to nourish our hearts and we focus on our heart and we open the heart and we feel that fullness on the heart, we have encouraged OGIS to enter there, right? If our heart gets tight and cold and hard, we've encouraged OGIS in a sense to exit there for a little while. Same with any other tissue of the body. Is this making sense?
Yeah. Would the subdoshas then also be, I mean, the subdoshas in that region are also part of this entering and exiting, the Pran Vayu, Avalambhaka,
I don't think about the subdoshas in this context, because really the subdoshas, there's one prana. There's not five pranas. There's one prana, and where it is in the body determines what it's going to be doing, what its job is. You train one police force, you send them out, and you send one guy to work on the traffic at an intersection. You send another guy to deal with the domestic violence dispute, another guy at an armed robbery. They're all doing different jobs, but they all have the same training. So I just, in this context, I just think of King Prana, like the prana that has to enter and exit every single cell in the body.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So okay. I don't bring the subdoshas into this. The subdoshas, I'm going to make this up, but I think I only really think about the subdoshas when I'm thinking about a particular disease and where it is. And then I sort of narrow down, okay, this is Apana Vayu, because we're talking about birth and afterbirth and postpartum, and so that's Apana Vayu. But the fact is it's just prana moving in a certain direction, right?
Right.
For the purposes of this, the lungs govern the entering and exiting of OGIS. I'm looking at the kidneys as one is on the left, one is on the right. They are the root of duality, the root of yin and yang. In Chinese medicine, that's what they, the root of yin and yang. And in fact, in Chinese medicine, they say that the kidney on the right is the root of yin. Yes, which is different than Ayurveda. In Ayurveda, we would say that the left side of the body is feminine. But in Chinese medicine, they have it exactly opposite, just to keep us on our toes. But I don't think it matters. I think that that's more of a metaphorical kind of thing. But they say that one kidney represents the root of yin and the other the root of yang. One represents the root of brahmana, one the root of lungana. And then the lungs, when we are breathing down into the lower part of the body, if we breathe into the kidneys, we are connecting the access point to the root, which is the lungs, and the root itself, which is the kidneys. Follow?
Yeah, right.
The Ida and the Pingala are these access points to the duality in our body. And if we engage the kidneys in that process, then we are connecting the access with the root. And so this is why breathing deep into the lower abdomen, even though the kidneys are in the back, you know, kind of higher than we think sometimes, if we can bring the back and the kidneys into a breathing exercise for that, which we are doing if we're breathing, like we talk about in the Nadi Shodhana track on the CD, you're bringing the prana through the channel down near the, it's near the kidney, it's near the spine, it's going through that area. The kidneys are responsible sort of for the whole low back area. And so getting the prana down in there and circulating it up and back is connecting the access with the kidneys. And then when we focus on things like, for example, when we would really be looking at this entering and exiting, I know this sounds like it has nothing to do with the thyroid yet, but the thyroid is complicated, so it's just a starting point to talk about this. But when we look at, for example, let's say use men as an example, we can talk about women too, but it's more common with men, and men say, okay, look, I have to have healthy shukra in order to have healthy ojas, and therefore I don't want to ejaculate and lose my shukra so that I can have good ojas, so that I can manifest things in the world in other ways or in my spiritual life or so forth. I recognize the value of ojas. I want to keep it, and so I don't want to ejaculate. So then they learn these techniques to not ejaculate during sex. Oops, because now we've violated Ayurveda 101, suppression of urges, right? And as soon as you suppress the urge to ejaculate, that prana gets backed up and stuck. And where in women, prana gets stuck mostly in the throat, the chest, and the reproductive organs. For men, I believe it's the prostate and the heart. And so what quicker way to increase stagnation are in the prostate area than to suppress ejaculation and call it quits? So what people would do, what priests and tantrics would do, to my understanding, is they had a whole practice of bringing the prana up from the reproductive organs, which, by the way, are also connected to the kidneys in Chinese medicine, the ovaries and the testicles. They're all part of the kidney system, this dual reproductive system, this dual root yin and yang system. That's why we have two of those, two testicles, two ovaries. So it's bringing in that concentrated root yin and yang energy. And so for men, what they would do is they wouldn't just leave it at stopping ejaculation. They would stop ejaculation and then circulate that prana that would have been released with the shukra on ejaculation. They spend hours every day in practices to circulate their energy up and down the spine, front to back, back to front, whether you're a man or a woman, and bringing that energy into organs. So one of the Taoist techniques for this was to stop ejaculation and pull that energy into specific organs that they knew needed strengthening. There's certain signs that the spleen is weak or the liver is weak or the kidneys, and they would bring that prana and that ojas into those organs and heal those organs. Similarly, there was a Taoist practice for women where they would stop the menstrual cycle. And I've had patients who have done this and stopped the menstrual cycle because that menstrual blood is different than regular blood, and it contains artava, right? So they would stop the menstrual cycle. And I've had patients do that, and they are not healthy people because, in my opinion, because the Taoist monk priestesses who would do this, they spent hours every day moving the energy. So it wasn't enough to stop the menstrual cycle or the ejaculation. You also had to have control over where the prana was going, the entering and exiting of, so that you could control the entering and exiting of the ojas, of where that was going, put it into certain organs that were deficient, circulate it through the rasa of the whole body if you just needed to increase the ojas in the whole immune system. It's not enough to just stop the ejaculation or stop the menstrual cycle. Or my guru used to say that the lubricant that comes to a woman when she gets aroused, that's her expression of shukra, female shukra, as ejaculate is for men. So the second that a woman becomes aroused and she gets lubricated, that's the expression of ojas there. And try to suck that back in, which is, you know, it's much easier to just circulate that in the body. But if you can circulate that, pull that in, circulate it in the body, that's the general idea, to preserve that. But it's not enough to stop it. You have to circulate it. So the entering and exiting of ojas, you take that sexual energy, which is nothing but just energy that is going to the lower chakras, in a sense. You take that energy and you infuse that and move it in the entire body. Much easier to do that as a daily practice, and then when this powerful urge comes up, you can incorporate that into your practice rather than trying to dig the well when you get thirsty, right? So I bring this up because if we look at these organs, that we've got the organs of duality, we can say the kidneys, the ovaries, the testicles, the adrenals, those are all related. Those are all the root of yin and yang in Chinese medicine. And I have practiced with that so long that I totally subscribe to that. I think that's absolutely true. When we outspend our resources emotionally, spiritually, energetically, physically, we dig into those resources, whether it's with coffee, which digs into the adrenals, throws adrenaline into the system, and then takes the credit for a surge of energy. You know, coffee doesn't give us energy. It steals some from the adrenals and throws it around and takes the credit, right? So, and when we're really tired and we keep pushing ourselves, we're reaching into the adrenals, we're reaching into that. And by adrenals, really, I mean to say we reach into that root source of yin and yang, which is connected with the adrenals and the ovaries and the testicles and the kidney system. That makes sense?
Yeah.
All right, to put this back to the bucket theory, when the bucket theory goes on long enough and we have that thing that I say in the healthier hormones where all else being equal, which basically means you don't have any kavagunyas to direct things, go in a different direction, all else being equal, first the adrenals get hit, then the insulin-producing portion of the pancreas, then the thyroid, right? So I was talking about all of this in relation to when I see that first level, what does that look like? What does adrenal burnout look like? I'm not looking for a blood test. I'm looking for, have you been outspending your resources and are you tired because of that? And are you depleting your root of yin and yang? So does that make sense in that context? Everybody with me?
Yeah.
Okay. So if I see that, I think, okay, bucket syndrome has gone on long enough. The root system is being drained. Then we go to the next thing, insulin-producing portion of the pancreas. This, if there's sort of blood sugar issues, and I sort of see that as weird cravings for sugar or carbs or whatever it is to kind of keep you going because you need this sort of rush or whatever. You might see some of that. You see the weight gain around the middle. That's the big telltale. That's mostly what I think about around that is you see this weight gain around the middle and the woman is eating well or and her exercise appropriate. So that's what I see with that, sort of plain and simple. Then we get to the thyroid. The thyroid can be either overactive or underactive, and we'll talk about that in a minute. We'll bring the Western stuff in a minute, the Western stuff so far as I can grok it, right, because I'm not a MD or an endocrinologist, right? But here's the simplest way to address thyroid issues. Everybody's going to ask me about it, and all I can give you is my own experience, right? And here's my experience with it. In a nutshell, what I would tell people is I'd try to explain the bucket theory as simply and quickly as I could and concisely as I could and say, when this happens, all else being equal, first your adrenals get hit, then the insulin-producing portion of your pancreas, and then your thyroid. So if all else being equal, if you've got a thyroid issue, what this tells us is the bucket syndrome has gone on too long. And the main fix is to reverse the bucket theory, is to fix the bucket problem. That's the main fix, and that's the tiny answer.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
It's the most important answer, really. All the other stuff we're going to talk about today is going to be understanding that more ourselves, increasing the ability for Naquan to understand, to see what's going on with the thyroid. But the simple answer is whether you have hypo or hyper Hashimoto's or Graves, whatever thyroid issue you have, it's most of the time in my experience because the bucket syndrome has gone on too long and you've got to change that. How do you change that? All the ways we've been talking about.
Right.
There's two ways we can ever, I'm making this up, but there's two ways that we can ever address a problem in the body. We can address it locally. So if we're talking about the thyroid, we can try to do things that target the thyroid and or we can address things systemically because if we can get the context right in the body, right, we've talked about context a lot, right? If we can get the context right in the body, it takes the pressure off the local problem and the local problem can just heal. You follow those two ways?
Yeah.
Right? And so in any given situation, we want to say, do we want to support this systemically, or do we want to go after it locally, or do we want to do both?
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is essential with any thyroid thing is to deal with it systemically. And sometimes that to deal with it locally. And we can talk about local things we can do specifically to support the thyroid. But the huge thing is systemic for any endocrine issues, because any endocrine issues, and now when we start getting into what the thyroid is and what it does in terms of Western medicine, and to the best of my knowledge, we're going to see it is not this little thing in the throat. It is completely connected systemically. And so we can't fix the throat and expect the thyroid to get fixed without addressing it systemically. Probably no organ system in the body stands alone. You've got the large intestine, and that's going to get fucked up if the small intestine is disturbed, and the small intestine is going to get screwed up if the stomach is disturbed, and they're all going to get screwed up if your emotions are disturbed, and your emotions are going to get disturbed if your guts are disturbed. So there's probably nothing that lies in isolation, which is why this two-pronged approach applies to anything in the body, and I'm making that up, but it's probably true, which, you know, do you deal with it locally or systemically? Sometimes it's too complicated to deal with something locally. Sometimes any herb you would give to the person to deal with something locally or any remedy might complicate five other things, and you're not really sure. Or maybe the person is just so incredibly sensitive and they're the 1 or 2% of people who come in to see you who doesn't matter what you give them, it doesn't act the way it should, theoretically. There is a small percentage like that, and if you're in practice long enough, you know it. There's, I think that percentage is rising, too, by the way, but I'm going to make this up. When I was first in practice, I think it was more at like 1 or 2%, and when I was done with practice, it was more like 5% of people, but small percent of people come in and you give them Trifla and they come in and they're like, you know, I am so constipated since I started taking that Trifla and I have this weird little feeling in my right left pinky toe. Maybe you can work out whether they're constipated because of it, but the right left pinky toe, sorry, I just don't get it. Or they take Shatavari and it makes them nervous. You know, it's like something you give them works the opposite way. It doesn't work like it should. So with these kind of people, it's very difficult to treat something locally, you know. Then with those people, you have to treat it systemically. And with endocrine stuff, if every organ in the body is dependent on the system for around it for its support, the endocrine system and organs is this in spades. You can't have it in isolation. And this is what we'll see with the thyroid, absolutely. So treating the thyroid, whether it's hypo or hyper, it really comes down as in the simple story, and we haven't got to the complex story yet, but the simple story is the bucket syndrome has gone on long enough to affect it, and you got to do the alternate nostril breathing and the Dinacharya and all that stuff to support the context. So that's the simple story, and that's the main one to get across. Why this is so, let's look at that. But the last thing I want to say about this is, you address the systemic problem, you know, the alternate nostril breathing and the restorative yoga and the Dinacharya, you would have that be the same treatment whether it was hyper or hypo. That would be the same. And my experience has shown me, and this could be right or wrong, perhaps it's just I've had a bizarre subsection of the population and as patients, but what I have come to is think that it's very rare to have a true hypothyroid situation. Hypo means underactive, right? Hyper is overactive or excessively active. So it's very rare to have a true hypo, like where you just really, you're lying on the couch getting fatter and fatter and, you know, there's no reason for it. That is, it's possible. But it would be a very, very strong genetic component, extremely strong. That would be very difficult to treat. It almost never happens in my experience. What is much more likely, in my opinion, is that everything is hyper when it starts because the thyroid is taxed, and then the thyroid bottoms out and becomes hypo. Right. So it's the same treatment for it. And I don't know that that's true. And it could be that endocrinologists would laugh me off the face of the planet, but it's been my experience. And when I hear other people talking about their experiences, it seems, you know, other practitioners who have a significant amount of experience, they seem to be saying the same thing to me. So I've found reinforcement for that over the time. And I just want to see, those of you who have seen a bunch of people, does this make sense to you?
Yeah. It's like the anxiety depression cycle. Yeah.
Okay. Good. So so that's the basic.
Claudia,
so,
I was told by a practitioner that, I was hypo now or a couple of years ago, but it started out as hyper. She was convinced of that, and she said then she thought it went to hypo. So I have heard that also.
Okay, yeah. So that's what it seems like to me. And the whole business, and I really like seaweed for thyroid. And the whole business of people saying you should avoid it for one and keep it for the other, I don't think that's true. I don't know, and you have to proceed with caution, but I think that the kind of iodine that's present in seaweed, provided you're trying to get seaweed that doesn't have radioactivity in it, right? But I think that it's sort of like the conversation about soy, where is soy good or bad? Soy has an affinity with the endocrine system, and if we can digest it, it can have a positive impact, and if we can't, it'll have a negative impact. I think it's a similar case, and this is just totally my opinion. Don't sue me. But I think it's the same with iodine. If you've got like a synthetic or highly processed form like you have in junk food snacks and the kind of salt that is that has, this sort of highly processed form in it, it's going to be bad for you. And if you have like a natural form like in seaweed, in a digestible form like that, or a natural form, let's say, because I think it's not too hard to digest salt in general, but a natural form of salt is going to, it may have a much better impact.
So you haven't seen seaweed make someone who's hyperthyroid worse?
I have one case where I'm not sure that it might have.
Okay. Because I haven't either, but I also don't prescribe it. So I was wondering if you actually tell people, eat some good quality salt or sources of iodine, even when they're hyper. Is that what you do? Yeah.
I really proceed with caution with it.
Okay.
Because full disclosure, my belief is that it's good for the thyroid with hyper. But since I couldn't prove that in a court of law, right? So I have to consider that it's at least controversial, right?
Right.
It's at least controversial. And so what I will do is leave it in the person's court and say kind of what I said to you all, like, I think it's possible that this could be beneficial, but there's a definite controversy around it. You could proceed with caution and try if you want and leave it in their court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What I would do with a hyper situation myself, and in fact, what I did, I was in a very, very busy position in my life at one point. I was going to school nights and working during the day, and I got what admittedly is self-described, but it was absolutely picture book, subacute thyroiditis. I would actually have pain in the thyroid and get a little fever in the evenings and sweat, and it was classic picture book, and I took seaweed. And they say it's self-limiting, situation, and that it'll resolve within, 3 to 6 months. I can't remember. It was a long time ago. But it resolved within a couple of weeks, and I did a lot of seaweed and other things that I do. And my personal experience with sort of a hyper profile, and that's just my personal experience, and with my patients, it's a question, but my belief is that it's good for it. But, it's sort of like it's my belief that it's good for it, but I couldn't justify that in a court of law.
Yeah.
So it's a weighty responsibility to tell someone to do it. So it's very proceedy with caution. Everybody understand that? And I could never tell you, yes, tell everybody it's okay and give it to them. I can't in good conscience say that. But full disclosure, my belief is it is. In terms of finishing out that general picture, again, absolutely treat systemically in all the ways we know, and it's again that experienced practitioner treats 100 different patients with one protocol. It's that, right? It's what we know. It's sitting down and troubleshooting with the person, what their motivating factor is, changing that, bringing the stress down, bringing the body's ability to handle the stress up. Alternate nostril breathing is the most important thing, right? Meditation, all that stuff, all that. any questions up till now?
What do you think about the iodine pills?
I haven't given that to people, but I think that there is a real possibility that that could be helpful if you go to someone who knows what they're doing. I never did that, but towards the end of the time where, you know, I had a practice for about 10 years and I've been doing it less. And towards the end of that, I went to a wonderful workshop with a woman in New Mexico who treated a lot with iodine pills and with thyroid and hypo and hyper. And she agreed with me, by the way, about the, and I really liked that because she was someone with a lot of experience. She was a nurse practitioner who worked with bioidentical hormones and iodine pills and endocrine system and so forth. And she agreed that, you know, hypo would go to hypo from hyper often and that you treat similarly. She did a lot of work with the iodine pills, and I found her very convincing and the arguments very convincing. But having had not had personal experience with that, there's a limited amount I can tell you about that. But I do think if you have someone who works with that and that you can talk to about the rationale is very convincing, and it's really worth looking at and worth trying out.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. So definitely treat things systemically in all the ways we know. I just wish every woman would take the Healthier Hormones course, because if she does that, then she's working on the context for anything in the endocrine system. And it makes my job so, so much easier. You know, it's sort of why I started, I think, prioritizing education over personal private practice, is because finding a way to help people work on this systemic thing is just so much more important than treating it locally. So locally just isn't going to turn the picture around. Here's the possibilities. All right. Remembering that this is what they say in Taoism, and I find this to be true, with women, qi, which is prana, tends to stagnate in one of three areas the most in a woman's body. Again, the throat, the chest, especially the breasts, and the reproductive organs. And how true is this? We get breast lumps, fibrocystic changes in the breast, breast cancer, reproductive stagnation, pain, painful periods, fibrocystic changes, endometriosis, infertility, stagnation. It happens there. And in the throat, is this because we're not expressing ourselves, we don't feel like we can, or we just hold tension there? Maybe it's just that simple. We just hold tension in our throats, but we are mostly bottlenecked. Right, which is why when we do the dissolving obstructions exercise on that CD, when we get to the neck, instead of breathing to the boundary of the pranamaya kosha at that level and back in, we breathe to the boundary of the pranamaya kosha and on the exhale continue to push the energy out, because it's bottlenecked here. We don't need to pull anything in. It's just in. And the release, if you've done that on those exercises, I find every time I do that, this relief feeling and release feeling to really open that up, that bottleneck. So doing those kind of things is a local thing that's very helpful, and it's going to help systemically. So doing the dissolving obstructions track and really paying attention when you get to that throat part, that's one local thing, but it's also systemic, because you'll start moving energy in the whole body and prana will be moving better. So it's that's good. So dissolving obstructions, and for the same reason, doing a castor oil pack over the throat to bring prana and blood flow more through here and open it up more. And if you can do the prana exercise or a shortened version of it, the version around the throat, and perhaps the chest too, so it opens up that whole area. It's hard to open up the throat if the chest is all tight. But if you do that dissolving obstructions track while you've got the castor oil pack on your throat, then it has even more of an opening effect. So opening that energy so that there's the stagnation moves through, so that prana and blood can move through, so it can bring nourishment and rasa to the thyroid area and take away waste. That is just, I think that's very helpful. When we do the thyroid pack, I don't leave it on the same amount as I do on the reproductive organs. I leave it on for a half an hour. And I don't know why. Nobody told me that. It just feels like more than that is too much. You know, that you want to do a little at a time, and you don't put heat on it. You just use the pack for about half an hour at a time, and it could be maybe three times a week. So that's one way I address it locally, is through the dissolving obstructions, through the prana work and the castor oil. And then seaweed. I mean, just seaweed is incredible. So you can get, there's a place that Chinese medical practitioners can get powdered seaweed that you can add to formulas and so forth, maywei.com, maywei.com. But I think it's only for Chinese practitioners, so you might not be able to get that. But if you can get it there, what I used to do was get kombu, which is kombu powder, and I would just add it to my herb mixes. And there's another one that you can get at Meiwei, which is called Haizao, two words, first word H-A-I, second word Z-A-O, and that's another seaweed, but all of the seaweeds are going to be helpful. Those are two seaweed powders they have there, and that was a very easy way to include it in a formula. And the formula would often look like something like, I'll give you sort of just a general idea. I'm making this up, but this would be sort of a general formula. What needs to happen with someone who's coming in with thyroid issues? Of course, the picture could be more complicated. They could have irritable bowel syndrome, and you have to take that into consideration. They could have digestive issues, in other words, and you'd have to take that into consideration. But all else being equal, if they can digest the herbs, if their digestion is good enough and their Agni is good enough, which is questionable because if the thyroid is screwed up, probably the Agni is screwed up, because the other main thing about the thyroid that I haven't mentioned is that it's the subtle, profound Jataragni of the tissues. You know, what Jataragni does for food, the thyroid does for tissue transformation in the body. Every tissue Agni, all the Agnis of the tissues are governed by the thyroid. So if the thyroid is off, the Agni of all the Dhatus is probably going to be off a little bit. And Jataragni is probably going to be off a little bit. So you're probably going to have digestive considerations. But if you didn't have any digestive considerations and you just had the bucket syndrome going on for long enough, the things that could be helpful are the kombu and the haizao, that's some seaweed powder. And you could probably supplement that with, you know, you could maybe find seaweed powder somewhere else. There's got to be something else on the internet, or kelp pills, things like that. I really like them in a formula, and the formula would tend to have ashwagandha in it because it stabilizes the nervous system and it's grounding and stabilizing is the best. And I like ashwagandha because it's like smells like a horse, but it's what it means. Really, it's such a stabilizing herb. You know, it's like the most stabilizing herb I know, I think. I'm just making that up, but it's almost like it should be stira, the stira herb or something like that. So it would have ashwagandha in it. Just, if I was making a mix, I would have five parts ashwagandha, three parts kombu, three parts haizao, one part bala, which bala means strength, right? Three parts bala. If the person didn't have any lumps, maybe three parts shatavari and then three parts vidari, so that we support the, you know, the brahmana, you know, the sex hormones. We support the stability of the nervous system, and we target the thyroid with the seaweed. I like putting the seaweed in with these other things because the seaweed has such an affinity for the thyroid that it can kind of act as a carrier for these other nourishing, stabilizing herbs to, you know, in guduchi, put maybe three guduchi in there, and maybe two licorice, because licorice also has an affinity with the endocrine system, with hormones. So this is a really stabilizing endocrine formula that adding the seaweed brings it, targets the thyroid with it, but it'll also, all these other things will just stabilize the endocrine system. So then the other thing I will just say, I mean, yoga that stretches the, like, cobra pose, lion's pose, where you go, that massages the thyroid, those kind of yoga poses that open the throat and massage the thyroid, those kind of things are good, and it's a good thing to send somebody to get acupuncture for, because acupuncture needles can open up that thyroid area so fast. I had one person who had Hashimoto's, and people, I kid you not, we had one session together with acupuncture. I gave her herbs. I could even pull up her chart and tell you what herbs I gave her. And one bag of herbs in one acupuncture session, and her Hashimoto's was turned around.
That's so cool. That's great.
Let me pull up her chart. She had had thyroid issues as long as she could remember. Her thyroid hurt. There was a little bit of swelling. There was a feeling of pressure and sensitivity. She had a diagnosis of Hashimoto's and had been hospitalized a couple of times, things like that, all right, just to give you a little background on her. And I did points that are nourishing for Brahmana. There's points that open the yin channel right in the body. And I kind of focused on that in terms of acupuncture. And the mix was, it's actually not going to be like that other one because she did have some other things going on. She had some inflammation in her lungs. So I actually had to give her some anti-inflammatory herbs. But along with that, gave her 3 kombu and 3 haizao parts and punarnava 5 because she needed that. Punarnava has an affinity with the thyroid too. And she also had this stuff going on with the lungs and needed to address that. So it's actually not as helpful as I thought. But she took that and, you know, the acupuncture and those herbs, one treatment. The next time, they couldn't find any abnormality with her thyroid. So I bring her into this for 2 reasons. One, to bring in, like, what actually was her herb mix, but that's not so helpful. But the other thing with that is you can have a thyroid issue or any issue for that matter that sounds really tenacious and nasty and how could you ever turn it around? And it can turn around in one treatment with one batch of herbs. And you can also have thyroid stuff or anything that doesn't look so bad that plods along and, you know, for years with minor changes. So very difficult to say how long it takes to turn something around. All right. Anybody have anything they want to bring in before we start going down the Western route?
What about nodules, like the nodules in the thyroid? Is that connected to like hypo and hyper, or is that different?
It is. And so if there's nodules, I will definitely use the castor oil pack. If there's nodules or swelling or goiter or anything like that, I will use the castor oil pack. And we got to understand that nodules is the perfect expression of a thyroid going whacked out. If I were to name the thyroid, maybe I would have to name it Tejas gland, because it is responsible for metabolism in tissues, you know, in like every tissue in the body, probably. I'm making that up, but it's at least a bunch of them. It's probably certainly all the dhatus. If Agni is low, even in some situations when it's high, then material isn't being transformed appropriately, and you could end up getting a nodule, right? Mass buildup. Make sense?
Yeah.
All right. So let's look at a couple of things. I always get confused, by the way, between Graves and Hashimoto's. I always forget which one is with, I know it today, but right, it's very, very common for me to forget which one goes with which. But generally, the Graves goes with hyperthyroid.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, hyperthyroid is the overactive thyroid, right? And so that's called Graves a lot. Maybe because we drive ourselves into the grave with hyperactivity, right? So we have a little mnemonic there. Hyperactivity creates hyperthyroid, which sends us to our graves, right? So it's a highly lungana thing, and it can lead to secondary masses like goiter, all right, or bulging eyes. You can have the goiter with that. Whereas Hashimoto's, chronic lymphocytic thyroiditis, is sort of mixed symptoms of yin and yang, mixed symptoms of lungana and brahmana. And it's the most common cause of primary hypothyroidism. So then we get real hypothyroidism. And you're an MD. If I'm screwing something up here, let me know, okay? So I think of this as this graduating thing, like this gradual thing that goes from hyperthyroid grave thing to Hashimoto's thing, which is sort of mixed, that goes to a, sort of a hypothyroid, which is more what we're going to see is more, we might see more brahmana things with that, like, you know, fatigue and inertia and things like that. So let me, it's confusing stuff here, but very interesting. So I'm going to just read you just a few symptoms that if we're familiar with this, we just get reminded. And if we're not familiar, we get a little familiar. So hyperthyroid, I wrote down a couple notes here. You can have goiter, you'll have tachycardia, right? And now look at these things. Think about, are each of these symptoms, when I look at Western symptoms, I'm thinking how to translate them into my understanding. So with hormonal things in the endocrine system, I find it much more useful to think about it in terms of brahmana and lungana than vata, pitta, or kapha, all right? Because it just, is it stimulating and motivating, or is it grounding? Is it overstimulated, or is it overnourished like masses? You follow? So let's look at this with hyperthyroid. You've got the thyroid being overactive, Graves' disease, and so would you expect, I'm gonna have you tell me, right? Would you expect there to be a slow heartbeat or a fast heartbeat?
If it's something fast, I would think fast. It's natural.
That's right. That's right. So this is going to be the lung. This is going to be lungana stuff. So you're going to get tachycardia.
Right.
You're going to get tachycardia is fast heartbeat, right? You're going to get warm, fine, moist skin, tremors. Atrial fibrillation, like a fluttery thing, nervousness, anxiety, activity, sweating, hypersensitivity to heat. You would get fatigue, which sounds sort of like brahmana because it's inertia, but it's because you're burning out, right? Appetite,
right.
Weight loss because of lungana, right? You've been highly stimulated and motivated for too long. Weight loss, insomnia because there's too much lungana. Weakness because there's not enough stability, and possibly frequent bowel movements, diarrhea, things like that. It can enlarge the thyroid to twice its size or more. And you just think about, why is there a goiter? Because if Agni is too high or too low, what it's trying to transform into energy is not going to be well transformed. It's kind of as simple as that, right? But it is a little bit weird because it's a lungana thing, you get all these fast stimulating symptoms, but then you get a mass, which is more of a brahmana symptom. So it's a little confusing, but if you think of it as, you know, look at all the other signs. All the other signs are going to be this person has burned out from outspending their resources, basically. Follow? All right. So then we get into Hashimoto's kind of territory. Let me see, is there anything else I want to say about No. So Hashimoto's, so now we're going to look with, we're going to try to see mixed symptoms of lungana and brahmana. And remember that this is the most primary cause of hypothyroidism. So this is going to end up, we're going to see some signs of lungana, some signs of brahmana, but we're going to realize that this person is on their way to burnout. Okay. So the symptoms here include weight gain, right, which looks like brahmana, but it's only because the thyroid is starting to conk out.
Got it.
Depression, which looks like brahmana, but it's only because we're burning out. Mania, because we're maniacs. Sensitivity to heat and cold, so now we get a mix of both of them. So we're seeing it's like this graduated thing. We've been hyperstimulated. The thyroid starts to conk out, so we start to get signs of crash, which look like brahmana, and then we really get it totally crashed, right? So this is the middle ground. Chronic fatigue with panic attacks, slow heartbeat and fast heartbeat, possibly congestive heart failure, high cholesterol, reactive hypoglycemia. You start getting possibly you can see other endocrine stuff with it, right? Hypoglycemia. So because, of course you are, because we've already passed the insulin producing portion of the pancreas stage, and of course you're going to see the adrenal stuff because you've already passed the adrenal stuff in the bucket syndrome list, right? cramps, memory loss, vision problems, infertility, hair loss. The thyroid gland may become firm, large, and lobulated, but changes in the thyroid can also be non-palpable. So you can have all this stuff without the goiter stuff. And then you get into hypothyroid. It's crashed, and it's often after Hashimoto's, and it usually results in a shrunken sort of fibrotic thyroid gland with little or no function. But remember, I had a patient with Hashimoto's that got turned around in one treatment, right? So I wouldn't think immediately if there's hypothyroid that there's nothing that can be done. Shrunken fibrotic thyroid gland, open it up, get some prana and blood in there. You know, use the kombu and the haitzao to get something there, and you know the seaweed, and put the castor oil pack on it and imagine prana going through it, because if you imagine it, it is happening. So those are sort of the three things that we see with Hashimoto's, kind of in that, you know, in that order of severity almost, or, you know, or long term. There's a lot more that I want to say about the thyroid, but we are out of time. And if there was nothing else I said about it, the rest of the stuff is just really cool and interesting from a Western point of view, and mixed into how we've been looking at it. But that's how I look at it in a nutshell, and that's how I treat it in a nutshell. And I've seen mixed results, mostly very good and sometimes incredibly good. Sometimes it takes a long time. Part of it is how willing somebody is to change their context, I think.
Right.
All right. Any last? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, one last thing. But just to comment, both Graves and Hashimoto's are autoimmune diseases.
Right.
Where our body is attacking our thyroid. So I just think that's really interesting. That's one of the primary autoimmune organs. You know, like, that's what we do as women. It's highly common in women.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because look at that. I mean, autoimmune is our bodies attacking ourselves. And what is happening here with the bucket syndrome? We're attacking ourselves in how we live and how we think and how we respond to things. We are attacking ourselves, and our body learns from us. So fascinating. I want to express how enjoyable this is for me as well, to go into these aspects that we never get to talk about and muck around, and it's so interesting to me. And thank you so much for the opportunity. I wouldn't have it if you weren't here. Let's take 30 seconds or so and just absorb and change gears. All right, everybody. Ciao.